doing, Met fans? We are back for another episode of the Terry Collins Show, presented by Tunnel the Towers, supporting America's greatest heroes. Donate just $11 per month by going to T2T.org. That's T, the number 2T.org. I'm John Arezzi, and here with me, maybe not as anxious as I am during the heat of this pennant race for the postseason, he's the man who has seen his share of September high-pressure baseball, former MLB skipper Terry Collins. Terry, how you doing this week?
I'm doing great, John. I'm really excited. You know, it's an exciting time in baseball. Anytime you're in a pennant race, boy, you know, there's a lot of energy going on. So I'm excited to see how the next 15 days plays out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's every game. The pressure is there. And I know, you know, you're in the game. You've been in the game. You manage. You've been there, done it. But for somebody like me who has lived and died with this team, it's like every pitch, every inning, every game ramps up that anxiety level. So, but it is exciting. I'll give you that. I'd rather have that than the alternative.
That's right.
Exactly. No doubt. All right. So let's dive into the Mets past week, a very successful homestand for the New York Mets. and we'll get to take a look at that upcoming schedule as well. But right now, the leadoff, it was a great week at home for the Mets. They won 8 of 9. They gained a lot of ground for the second week in a row. It's really, Terry, a tale now of 4 teams and 3 wild card spots. Mets and the Braves tied for the third spot. They're both just 2 games behind San Diego, who has the top wild card spot, and they're just now a game and a half behind the defending National League champion Arizona Diamondbacks. So can this get any more exciting as we all head into the final weeks of the regular season?
It can't, John. I mean, they just showed you what can happen when you have a hot streak. I mean, you can gain huge ground up, and that's why you have to take care of your business, even though, again, we're not naive to think that the players aren't aware of what's going on the other at the other places that are involved. But, man, this is when you got to worry about tonight and tonight only. And when this game's over, then you focus on tomorrow's game. You can't have whatever happens tonight, win or lose. Hey, look, you're still in the hunt, so you worry about tomorrow. And it's a great time to be in a pennant race. There's nothing better than that.
Oh, I agree. Even though the Mets lost a pretty tough finale against the Reds on Sunday, you got to have a look, and you got to take a look at that outing by Luis Severino, who made another amazing outing. He gave up just 1 run over 6 2/3, 8 strikeouts, just 5 hits, only 2 walks. This guy is pitching his best baseball in years.
In years. I mean, and he's never thrown this amount of innings. I mean, there's a lot of things, and you would think at this time of year, you know, you'd start to get fatigued, and he's not. He's, you know, he's pitching as good as he has all summer. Manaea's pitching very well. Quintana had a good outing. David Peterson's been great. So their starting pitching has really, really been solid. And yeah, it would have been nice to have Senga, whether he comes back or not. But you've still had getting good, solid starting pitching. And their bullpen in the last 10, 12 games has been off the charts great.
Yeah, I wanted to touch upon that pitching. The starting pitching rotation has been spectacular. Their staff ERA is just 2.05 over their past 10 games. Truly amazing again. And the bullpen has been solid. Can the Mets pitching now be their best asset as each game takes on more of a playoff atmosphere?
Well, it could be, John. But, you know, one of the things it does, when you're really pitching good, it just kind of makes it easier on the offensive side. You know, if you're pitching scuffing and you're thinking, God, we got to score 5 runs today to win a game, you know, that's tough for an offense. But now, they're not giving up hardly any runs. And so the offense says, hey, we got to go out and good 2 or 3 runs. We're going to win. And so it just makes it easier on both sides. But, you know, the game has always been about starting pitching, basically, but pitching all together. And when you're pitching well, you're gonna get on a hot streak.
Yeah, it's all coming together on the pitching side, and that offense has been really hot. But you know, you need them to step it up even more to give even those pitchers a break. If they have a 4 or 5 run lead, it makes it easier on everybody. I want to take a look at one guy who's made a really big difference, who is not even a factor until May 15th when he was given that third base job. And that guy is Mark Vientos. He has an OPS close to 900. He's got 24 home runs. He's emerged as perhaps one of the best young sluggers and top three third baseman in baseball. Two home runs on Friday night, his first at bat, and then that walk-off in his last at bat, will that'll be sure to be on the 2024 highlight video. Have you? What have you seen during this evolution of Vientos this year? And how big of a role have the veterans on this team, like a J.D. Martinez, impacted him?
Well, to start out with, first of all, you know, I thought what happened to Mark Vientos in spring training proved that he's a professional. You know, he didn't make the club. He had a good spring, still didn't make the club. And you have two options. You can either go down and mope and pout about not making the team, and or you can go down and prove him wrong. That, hey, look, you belonged on that club. And that's what Mark did. He did just what he went down, started tearing up in AAA. When Beatty started having struggles, they said, well, let's bring this other guy up. He's playing great. And he grabbed that opportunity and ran with it. And those are the kind of guys you like. I love those. I love guys who grab that opportunity and just take off with it and show you that, hey, look, you made a mistake, but I'm staying here and this is my job. And that's what Mark has done. And I think the effect of what J.D. Martinez has done on that club, he's had several meetings where he talks about his ideas of hitting, which is, you know, and he made up all of this stuff, you know, for years by himself, because I saw this J.D. when he was in the minor leagues. Good hitter, got to the big leagues, didn't do very well out of the gate, got released, got signed on, had a chance to, you know, another chance to get in the big leagues, and just really studied the art of hitting and has become one of those team gurus that you turn to when you want to talk about what it takes to be a good major league hitter. And, you know, you watch him hit, he hits the ball from the right field line to the left field line. He's got power all over the ballpark and knows it. So what all he wants to do is put good, solid swings on the baseball, and you're watching Mark Vientos do exactly the same thing as JD. And you look around at that lineup, everybody in that lineup now, they just, hey, look, all they want to do is put a good swing on the ball. They're hitting opposite field homers, and that's why every night somebody different is coming through for the Mets.
Yeah, that's certainly true. The Mets did lose Jeff McNeil for the remainder of the season with a wrist fracture during Friday's win. He got hit in the wrist by a pitch. It wasn't thought about, you know, anything serious that night, but they did testing the next day. His wrist had swelled up, and it revealed a low-impact fracture, but a fracture nonetheless. He is now not due back this regular season. If the Mets get into the playoffs and they get deep into the playoffs, maybe you'll see him back. But the question, Terry, is were you surprised when DJ Stewart was brought up to replace Jeff rather than an infielder like Luis Angel Acuña, who's been playing second base, shortstop, center field in Syracuse? His name has been tossed around. Carlos Mendoza is saying, well, he needs to play every day, and there's only a couple weeks left in the minors. But were you surprised with that decision where DJ was brought back rather than a guy like Acuña?
I was not, John. At this time, you know, this isn't the time where you want to bring a rookie up and you know, throw him into the fire in a pennant race. You take a veteran guy, bring him up. Obviously, Stewart's done a good job off the bench. I mean, he was doing great for – he carried the club for a week or 10 days by, you know, when he was swinging so good. But he's used to being in the big leagues. And, you know, that's nice to bring those rookies up sometimes where you can blend them in, you know, as you're late in the season. But right now it's, you know, when you've got 15 games to go, 16, whatever it might be, you know, you've got to have that veteran leadership and those veteran guys who don't feel necessarily the pressure that a young guy might feel if he's slammed in the lineup. And, you know, it's the easiest thing to say, hey, we want you playing every day, because if they do have another injury, if something happens to Iglesias, Acuña's got to be the guy. So you might as well let him play while he has the chance to play.
Yeah, with only 2 weeks left in that minor league season as well, maybe it's a strategy where let's give him a chance every day, and if we need him at the end of the season, he's an option for us. Terry, taking a look at the upcoming schedule, after Toronto, the Mets are north of the border right now playing the Blue Jays. They will then travel to that city of brotherly love, and there's no love there for the New York Mets fans, of course, who will be making a pilgrimage for that critical three-game set against the Phillies. Then they return home for a final homestand of the regular season, three against the Nationals, four against the Phillies, so seven games against the division leaders, who are still within striking distance. In baseball history, crazy things have happened before. Terry, what are the give us your assessment on the Mets' upcoming road trip, them coming home for that final series. And also, I'd like to ask you, what are some of the wildest finishes to a season that you remember during your career?
Well, obviously, as I said earlier, you know, it's every game now is important. Every game is big, especially when you're going to play teams that are playing for positioning. You know, you're going into Toronto, and, you know, right now the Blue Jays, they would do like nothing more than to spoil your season. But when you go into the field, when you play the Phillies seven times, I'm telling you, it is going to be game time. It's going to be on. The Phillies want to, you know, they want to clinch. They have a chance to, you know, if they beat up the Mets during those seven games, they got a chance to clinch it and be, you know, move on, get ready for the playoffs. But you also, if the Mets get hot and play great, they're going to be stinking, breathing down the Phillies next for the division title. So it's going to be a huge next 2 weeks. Because every game, and I don't care if you're playing the Nationals or not, I mean, again, we've talked about it, John, they're big leaguers still. And so what you've got to go out, you've got to look at every night is it's the most important game of the season.
Yeah, certainly. And any memories of any wild finishes that stand out in your career that you've seen maybe as a skipper or even not?
Well, I mean, you can go back. I mean, you look at what happened to the Mets many years ago. You know, they had – I think a 7 or 8 game lead with 12 to play or something and lost it. So
2007. Yeah.
I mean, you know, I wasn't a Met then, but you know, it does happen. And I've seen teams come out of nowhere. We've watched the Arizona Diamondbacks last year, barely get in the playoffs. The next thing you know, they're playing in the World Series. So, you know, there's crazy stuff can happen. That's why it's a great game. And that's why you've got to play 162. And they, you know, at the end, you just never know which game is going to be the most important win or the most devastating loss of your season. But, you know, baseball is such a highs and lows that, you know, the fan base, you have a bad May, break up the team, you know, get a new, and then all of a sudden you have a great June. Oh, let's go to the trading deadline. Let's go get every good player that's out there. So, but that's why it's an exciting sport. You know, because there's so many games that are played, you get to ride the wave for a while, but then you got to tread water for a while. And that's why I love it. Anything can happen, and it's not over until someone says, hey, you're done.
Yeah, this is the most exciting season for me since 2015. And Terry, finally on the leadoff here, because of the incredible run, there's a lot of people comparing this 2024 team to your team in 2015. It's been the banter on SNY with your colleagues there, other members of the media, and of course fans on the internet. But I'm going to go right to the guy who was in the dugout leading the team 9 years ago. Are there any similarities in your opinion? If so, what are they? And also, what are the differences between your club and the 2024 Mets?
Well, as you know, John, the game has changed quite a bit. I mean, the rules have changed immensely to what's going on. But, you know, with what we're seeing right now, their starting pitching has been very good. In 2015, we had great starting pitching. Now, we went out and we got ourselves two guys in the bullpen, Tyler Clippard and Addison Reed, who really bridged that 7th and 8th inning gap so we could get to Jeurys Familia in a 9th inning. And the Mets, now that Diaz is back being the dynamic closer that we all know he can be. Now, all of a sudden, you've taken Reed, you've taken Ottavino, you've taken Danny Young, and you've put these guys in roles now that you can bridge those, you know, 2 innings instead of 4.5 innings that they were having to do earlier in the season. You not only have to get through to it. So that's a similar trait. We got Cespedes at the trading deadline. And what he was sliding him in the middle of that lineup, you know, gave us that guy we really relied on, that huge hitter. But, you know, Lindor, basically, he's putting up the same kind of years that, you know, that Cespedes did. Yeah. I mean, plus surrounded by, you know, with what Pete's done. Even though Nimmo hasn't been hitting like we know he can, he still, you know, look up and he seems like he's on base all the time. And yeah. Mark Vientos is came into the fold, as did Conforto when we brought him up.
Right.
He became a dynamic member of our lineup every night. So, you know, there's a lot of similarities that were like on both teams. That's why I really believe I think the Mets are going to get in. And I think when they get in, they're going to be a tough team to play.
Yeah, I think so. And for me, just seeing the fan base, the eruption of the fan base, the more people showing up, it's that atmosphere and it lifts the club up and they're fully behind the team. And it's just kind of a similarity to me is 2015, 2024, the fans and just how exciting and magical this all seems to be. So we ride the wave, like you say, and I'm with you. I think they're going to make it. And I think they're going to be a tough team in the postseason. Well, Terry, this week we had a great call with Peter, Tunnel to Towers Foundation, about your involvement with the upcoming annual 5K run and walk taking place in New York City on September the 29th. Registration is still open for the event with a post-run concert by the Zac Brown Band. Terry, how's your training going?
It's going fine, John. It's going fine. I you know, you sent me a clip of a race, what the race was a couple years ago, I guess. And the only thing I don't want to do is get trampled. I can tell you that right now. I'm 75 years old. The last thing I need is do, you know, be caught up with all those soldiers and all those firemen carrying all that equipment. I'm going to stay off to the side. I can tell you that. My goal is to finish. That's my goal is to run across the finish line. And that's, I don't know how fast I'm going to do it, but I'm very, very anxious to do it because it's a great event for a great foundation.
Yeah, that video was certainly heartwarming. And also, Terry, I certainly recommend that as you are walking, running during this race, no autographs and no selfies with anybody as you're completing it.
I hope not. I don't want, John, anytime you're running, you get a pace going, you got to maintain the pace. So you don't want to be distracted, but I'll be very aware of who's around me. Cause again, I don't need to be jumbled around too much anymore.
No. Well, it's just amazing that you're doing it and participating and you've become such a great ambassador for them, as Peter had said in our call. And this is such a big, race, for them, this event, it really retraces the heroic footsteps of FDNY firefighter Stephen Siller. 9/11, Siller ran through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel into the Twin Towers where he was killed. The foundation was started in his memory, and that's where the name Tunnel to Towers comes from. And one thing that Peter also mentioned to us, Terry, is when the runners come out of that tunnel, they're greeted by firefighters holding banners with the names and faces of the 343 FDNY members killed on that day. It's a very emotional high point of that whole event. And before we wrap it up and go to a brand new commercial with New York Mets bench coach John Gibbons for Tunnel to Towers, we want to mention the upcoming Heroes Cup event taking place this week, Saturday, September 14th. First responder hockey teams from across the New York area will be competing for the cup at the Menin Arena in Morristown, New Jersey. Proceeds will benefit Tunnel to Towers. All right, Terry, it's time for that new commercial with New York Mets bench coach John Gibbons. Let's go to that.
Hi, I'm bench coach John Gibbons. Let's go Mets. Let's help the Tunnel to Towers Foundation.
I'm involved in professional baseball, right? And, you know, kids, people look up to, you know, we're not the real heroes. Military vets, firemen, and cops, those are your real heroes. We all don't lay it on the line, but we sure look for them when we need something, don't we? A simple donation of just $11 a month will go a long way to support our first responders, military families, and our veterans who are in need. These are the true heroes who protect us all.
Okay, TC, Gibby involved with Tunnel of Towers with a commercial. You've done one. We've got Johnny Franco. There's been so many. Just great participation this year. We're going to check out this week in Mets history, and this is going to be a kind of a special one for you. It was the weekend of September 7th of 2015. Your Mets went to Nationals Park in Washington, D.C., having just lost a series in Miami, and you were four games up on the Nationals. The opener of the series saw an 8-5 win, most remembered by the David Wright emotional home plate fist bump, which unleashed a lot of stored energy waiting to explode. And then on September 8th, the Mets staged an amazing comeback, which we're going to take a look at right now.
In New York and Washington, Matt Harvey, in the midst of this innings controversy, does himself no favors in the bottom of the first, facing Clint Robinson with two on and two down.
And he pulls one through the shift of base hit. Rendon around third. He'll come home with the first run of the game. Clint Robinson with an RBI single, and the Nats lead 1-0. And he goes after the first pitch and has a base hit. That chases home Escobar with the second run of the inning. An RBI single for Ian Desmond, and the Nats are up 2-0. Here's Ian Desmond. Will he be bunting? He just had a chat with the third base coach, Bob Henley. First pitch, he squares, he bunts hard, back to the mound. Harvey bobbles the ball, goes to third anyway, way too late, and the bases are loaded. Harvey sets. Here's the 0-1. Fastball line to center, base hit. Escobar scores. Robinson to third, the ball overrun by Cespedes. It goes all the way to the wall. Everybody might score. Robinson's in, Desmond's in. Around third, digging for the play. Taylor, he will score standing. Four runs come home. And it is 7-1 Nationals here in the sixth inning.
Bases loaded, two out. Mets down by five in the seventh. 3-1 to Granderson. And it's outside, ball four. It forces in a run, and it'll bring Cespedes to the plate as the tying run. Bases loaded, two out. Mets have two runs home in the seventh. Cespedes, the tying run at the plate. The Mets down 7-3. Facing Drew Story. Cespedes drills one down the line. That'll go to the corner. Flores is in. Uribe right behind him. Here comes Granderson. The relay throw to the plate. Not in time. A three-run double for Yoenis Cespedes. The Mets have scored five runs in the seventh. This is now a one-run ball game.
Now Storen has walked the next two hitters. 3-0 coming to Duda.
And he walked him to force in the tying run. The sixth walk of the inning issued by the Nationals bullpen brings home the sixth run of the inning as Cespedes scores to tie the game at 7.
2-1 to Darno.
And Travis rifles one to right center field, overcomes Harper, and he makes the running catch to end the inning.
Sean Neuenheis batting 207 with three homers, going up against the veteran right-hander Jonathan Papelbon. The 1-0 pitch. Into the air to deep right center. This baby's going. It is going. It is gone. Holy smokes. Kirk Neuenheis has given the Mets the lead. This place is in shock. And frankly, so is this booth. It is 8-7 New York.
Jerry's Familia, who comes in for the save.
And the most delicate of ones.
Anthony Rendon is 2-for-4 tonight. You think he's still going to be bunting 3-1?
No.
Can't.
And he bunts it hard down to Duda, has a play in second, gets the out, no relay, and the Mets pick off the lead runner. The bunt is unsuccessful.
Brings to the plate Junel Escobar, who already has three hits tonight. Familia ahead of him 0-2.
Bouncing ball, Wright's got it, to second for one, Murphy to first, double play, and the ball game is over!
Mets earn the stunning 8-7 comeback win to increase their lead over the Nationals.
That's exciting.
It was incredible. Yeah. That was incredible. Yeah, you got excited just watching it. But I mean, that emotion in that dugout after, you know, when you saw Kirk hit that home run, I'm telling you, you couldn't believe the energy in the dugout. It was off the charts.
Yeah, then you came back for another victory and swept the series. And was that the time you kind of knew, all right, I think we've put them to bed at this point? And
absolutely. You know, people don't, you know, one of the things that kind of goes unnoticed, Drew Storen was one of the best relievers in baseball. And we absolutely knocked him 2 days in a row. We beat him up pretty good. And I'll tell you what, boy, you know, you talk about losing some confidence, and he was never the same after that series.
Wow. Wow. I mean, when you go in with a 4-game lead too, and you come out with a 7 and it's September, it's kind of like, all right, maybe we could take a deep breath now. And it was an exciting season, Terry. And I was in Cincinnati when you guys clinched. J.P. Ricciardi had gotten me some tickets, and it was a few hours from Nashville, and what an exciting, what a great season that was. So it's really cool to be able to talk to you each week about this stuff, but that was a great clip to watch. All right, so TC, what we're going to do now is we're actually going to have an encore of a very first Talking with TC that we did on our debut show. And it's hard to believe we've done 22 of these now. And this was the first one we taped back at the end of March. So let's go to this special encore Talking with TC with none other than the one and only number 5, the captain David Wright.
Now it's really time for the first ever Talking with TC, and we're excited about this one. So let me talk to you, everybody out there, and you'll know who this is once I get into it. Our first guest on Talking with TC played his entire career with the Mets organization, 7-time All-Star, 2-time Gold Glover, 2-time Silver Slugger Award winner. His 1,585 games with the Mets are the second most in franchise history, just behind Ed Cranepool. And he ended his career holding the franchise record for hits, runs, total bases, doubles, RBIs, walks, sac flies, and extra base hits. He got the nickname Captain America after the 2013 World Baseball Classic, hitting .438 in that tournament. But to the Met fans, he's simply known as the Captain. It's an honor to welcome David Wright to the Terry Collins Show.
Thanks for having me. You forgot leader in strikeouts, probably errors, and probably a lot of other things too. So I feel honored to be the first guest. So thanks for having me, TC.
Well, David, it is without a question an honor to do my first show and have you be the first guest. I mean, it's very cool. Our relationship is great, but you know, it was so fun to watch you play for so long. And, you know, I just thank you for coming on the show and get kicking off this initial podcast that I'm going to try to do this year.
Well, you know, you're the best, and, you know, I'd do anything for you. So thanks for having me, and I'm excited to talk some baseball. Let's do it.
Yeah, I think we should. You know, David, as we were getting ready for this podcast, and of course, we were trying to discuss who was going to be on, and I said, you know, we got the ideal guy, and I know he'll be on. And I said, you know, there's some things I've always wanted to ask you that I never really did ever get to ask you. And that, you know, the one was, you know, when you got first to the big leagues, when you got called up the first time, you know, every rookie, you know, he comes up and his eyes are, you know, big and he's so excited about being there. What guy in that clubhouse made an impact on your career when you were first got to the big leagues?
That's a great question. And there's a lot of them, but there's actually two that I've talked to in the last 2 days. So they come to mind, and that's Joe McEwing and Cliff Floyd. Those two guys for me took me under their wing. Joe, I lived in the same apartment building as Joe. He'd take me to the ballpark. He taught me how to get to the ballpark. This was before all the GPS and all that stuff. So I remember sitting in his passenger seat of his rental car, writing down directions as we're going, you know, over the Triborough into Queens and take exit so-and-so and make a right here and a left here. And then obviously Cliff Floyd, really, really took care of me. He taught me, that you have 2 ears and one mouth for a reason, to listen twice as much as you talk and to take it in. Cause I had a veteran group and a lot of those guys gave me a little bit that I tried to take from each of them, whether it's Al Leiter, John Franco, Mike Piazza, you know, and tried to apply it to my game. So I had a very veteran group, but those two in particular really took me under their wing.
You know, Dave, was there one thing, you know, as you're getting ready to play, was it the game prep? What was it that you took from them that you then initially gave to some of the guys when you were the captain, those young kids that were coming up, they're maybe still there today, that you said, hey, look, this is a piece of advice that I got my first year. I've never forgot it, and you related to them. Anything come to mind?
I remember being an 18-year-old, my first spring training, semi-fresh out of high school, and, you know, eyes wide open, bushy tail, just so excited to be in Port St. Lucie for my first minor league spring training. And I remember we used to have early work, and we'd get there at the crack of dawn, you know, maybe 6, 6:30, eat breakfast and have our early work, say, starting at 7, which is early for a baseball player. And, you know, I remember walking out to the backfields and hearing this commotion going on one of the backfields. And I'm like, man, what is that? So I like being places early. So I mosey on back there and I see Mike Piazza, you know, arguably probably the best hitting catcher of all time, Hall of Famer, working on his catching at 7 o'clock in the morning on a backfield in Port St. Lucie in February or early March in spring training. And that always stuck with me. And I always told myself, if Mike Piazza can go work on his defense at 7 o'clock in the morning in spring training when he's already at Hall of Famer, you know, I never can say that I'm good enough. I always need to keep working. And that lesson stuck with me.
You know, that is impressive. And that's, You know, that's one of the, we'll probably get into it shortly, but that's where, you know, my time when I go back now and I watch the minor league kids practicing and stuff. And, you know, that early morning stuff comes early, but, you know, there's no replacement for working. And that's where, you know, I've always thought, you know, your game prep was off the charts great. And you never missed a day. You never missed a workout. You never missed, you know, as you got ready for the season. I remember, you know, we sat down one of the first days and we talked about how many at bats you needed for spring training. And even in spring training, you said to me the one time about, you know, hey, look, I got to go back to back. You know, you don't need a day off every other day. I need to go back to back once in a while. So, you know, those are things that as a manager, you know, you hear your star player talk about, hey, look, I want to work hard. That's the stuff I think that, you know, plays that runs throughout the entire organization.
And let me say this quickly. I remember Terry Collins running the minor leagues for the Dodgers when I was in the minor leagues for the Mets. And I remember that enthusiasm. And I remember looking over at the Dodgers organization and thinking, you know, wow, this is big time. And it starts with Terry Collins, who's running the minor leagues, running from field to field. And that's why I was so excited when we hired you as manager. I wanted that enthusiasm. I wanted that excitement because I remember as a young kid seeing you kind of set the tone in that spring trainings or whether it's minor league games in the middle of August in, you know, whatever town when it's a million degrees. You know, I remember you setting that tone, and that's why I was so excited, you know, to not only play for you, but to learn from you and kind of bring that enthusiasm to the big league level.
Well, I'm gonna jump in on that because no, go ahead, Terry.
No, I was just going to say, so David, you know, as we get into this and John, if you want to add something, please jump in because, you know, The one thing about it, we're going to get how we know how he feels and he's not going to pull any punches with us. I can tell you. So.
No, really, because when I hear David talk about him seeing you running the minor leagues, running spring training for the Dodgers, because I always loved seeing the interaction between you and David on the field during your tenure and David as a player. And this question was really for both of you. It was the first one I had for you guys. It's like there's no doubt about the mutual respect, the admiration you had for each other. And I wanted you to both talk about that bond and how it's endured to this very day. David first, and then to you, Terry.
Okay.
Well, I think one of the things that always stuck with me, you know, besides Terry's enthusiasm and his upbeat, positive attitude, has always been that he had this open door policy where, you know, once a month, once every couple of weeks, he'd gather the veterans and we'd go in his office and we'd have kind of a state of the union per se, where Terry'd be like, hey, give me what's going on in the clubhouse. Give me how you're feeling. Give me, you know, what I could do better, what we could do better, you know, both baseball wise and off the field, the culture in the clubhouse. And that's something that having that open door policy and that line of communication with your manager, I think is one of the most critical features. Maybe even more so than teaching the game of baseball is being in touch with your players and taking their temperature every now and then as to how things are going, because inevitably you're around these guys so much that you're going to get in these little spats or these little arguments or these little fights. And the reason for these meetings is to kind of come back together and say, okay, let's hash it out. You know, if we got some issues, whether it's with, you know, the third baseman or the manager or the star pitcher, whatever it is, let's hash it out behind closed doors and figure it out and let's move forward. And I think that that's something that I always appreciated with Terry is that open door policy and that ability to communicate with all the players.
Well, you know, John, I will tell you the first time I met David, I had been hired as the field coordinator and I came down to Florida in January to get ready. We opened up the complex here for guys and I was having dinner one night and this guy comes over and he said, just wanted to introduce myself. I'm David Wright. And I'm thinking, wow, this guy came over to say hi to me. That's pretty impressive. This is the star player. And that struck me so, I mean, I was so impressed by that he would take the time just to come over and introduce himself because, you know, he's a star. He didn't need to have to worry about that. But it was how he went about things after that. You know, when David talked about the open door stuff, you know, there were times during a season where I knew I had to get this guy a day off. I mean, he's always played 155 to 161 games, 62 games. So I don't know, every couple of weeks I would call him off. I'd come off to the side and I'd say, hey, look, I got to get you a day off this week. And he would say, what are you thinking? I'd say, well, how about Thursday? And who's pitching? And I told him, well, maybe this guy. And he would say, I'll tell you after the game on Wednesday. because that's his love for the game, his you know, his passion to play for the game. And that's what made for me, you know, this guy, he didn't want days off. He wanted to be on the field. He knew his worth to the ball club. And he just, even though he knew he probably could use a day off now and then, he knew his importance to the team. And that's where I felt, you know, hey, look, the Stars, they get it. They understand how important they are, and they're going to be out there. And this guy did it better than anybody else around. I mean, there were times that this guy played. I mean, the year he got hurt, he never said a word. He just showed up, got ready, and played good. And played. Finally, his neck was still stiff. He probably couldn't turn it anymore, but he just kept playing and playing. But I tell you, to get this guy a day off was tough, man. I mean, really tough.
You fought pretty.
You know,
hard,
the other
David.
Thing, John. I'll tell you the other thing I saw in New York. Every person that ever came in, if the community relations department or anybody else, the one guy they wanted to meet was David Wright. And so they would come in the clubhouse into the outside. They wouldn't come in the main clubhouse, but there was a little room off to the side, and they'd come in and say, "Hey, David, I've got Joe Blow out here. He wants to meet you." And every time David grabbed the 30 seconds to a minute and went out and said hi to the guy. Now that's respect for the fans and for the game itself. And in that town, it played without a question.
Hey, I remember when my nephew was, I think, 5 or 6 years old, we went to a game in Atlanta at the Westin Buckhead, and he saw David on the steps going up to where the Palm Restaurant was there in Westin in Atlanta, and he goes, "That's David Wright." I was like, "Well, I'm sure, you know, he'd say hello to you." And he goes, "I'm afraid." And then all of a sudden, it's like, I just said, "David, do you have a second?" And you came down and you took a picture with my nephew, and he'll never forget it. And that was just so memorable. But yeah, what a great, everyone wanted to say hello to David. And David, I don't know if you know this, or even Terry, if you know this, we're taping this on March 21st. And on March 21st, 2013, 11 years ago, David, do you have any idea what happened that day? Or should I refresh your memory?
I mean, I have a feeling that this day had something to do with being named captain.
That is correct. on this day in 2013, you were named the fourth captain in the history of the New York Mets. Gary Carter and Keith Hernandez were co-captains in the 80s. Johnny Franco, captain from 2001 to 2004. You became captain in 2013. What did that mean to you at that time? And I want to talk to Terry about that, too. I want to get his opinion on that. And what was that appointment of captain? What did that mean for you at that time? And what should the role of a captain for a team in today's era be?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because every time you bring that up, it brings a big smile to my face. And looking at Terry brings a big smile, too, because he was the one that delivered the news to me. And one of the best days of my career. You know, certainly being viewed in the light of a Terry Collins and his coaching staff and the front office and ownership and players in that kind of role was something that I took very seriously. And to this day, I feel like one of the biggest honors that I've ever received. So, you know, to be viewed as a captain or a leader for the organization, for the city, for the fan base, for my fellow, you know, players, you know, was incredibly amazing. And you could see by the smile that it's something that, you know, I cherish to this day.
You know, John, I will tell you, I approached David that spring and asked him if he'd ever, you know, that I would like to name him the captain. And he said, I don't think so. And I said, "Well, think about it and get back, and we'll talk about it again." So we talked about it later, and he said, "I want to, before we talk, I want to go find out about with my teammates how they would feel about it." And that is why, one of the reasons why I wanted him to be the captain. I didn't want him to make speeches. I didn't want him to have to get up in front of the club and give a pep talk. I wanted him to lead by example. You've already heard about him talk about, you know, that he's on the field, an all seven-time All-Star at 7 o'clock in the morning in the cage, taking ground balls, his respect for the fans, signing autographs, taking a picture with your nephew in a hotel on the road, the respect for the media in New York. you know, always available. And there's a lot of places you won't find this, but in New York, you have to be in front of your locker when that game is over. This guy's in front of the locker. You know, he answered the questions. He answered them properly. His respect for his teammates. I mean, all of those things are what, for me, is what leadership is. It isn't about how good a talker you are. It's about how you go about things. And, you know, and I used to ask David, hey, can you talk to so-and-so? Because I thought his impact as a peer player had a lot more clout when he would talk to a player about an issue as opposed to the manager. You know, the players get tired of hearing the manager talk. But when you have someone that's locker next to you who's going through the same things you're going through, who's been through the same things you're going through, you know, it means a lot more. And this guy never said no. And that's why he was, for me, the ultimate captain.
And today's day, captains, there are not very many of them, really. And I know the Mets have several guys. Well, maybe this guy should be a captain. Lindor shows his leadership abilities. Of course, Pete Alonso is the you know, kind of the face of the organization. What does the role of a leader mean today? I mean, has it changed? You think the role has changed if someone is appointed captain today in comparison to when, David, you were playing?
You know, I think for me, it was something that I never wanted to do different. You know, I think that I was honored with that title for a reason, and I didn't need to change something or become all of a sudden this boisterous, loud, speech-giving motivator that, you know, just really wasn't me. There was a time and place to, you know, get on somebody, or there was a time and place to hold a team meeting and to get up and say a few words, but I always respected and followed the types of players that didn't do that very often, because when they did do it, it meant a lot more. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I reserved that for, and Terry and I talked about it before. You know, we'd go through a stretch where we just stunk, and, you know, I'd look at Terry and be like, hey, you know, how you feeling? You know, you think now's a good time? And we'd have that dialogue. And that's what made it so great, is that, you know, I wanted to hear what Terry thought as well. And, you know, when, you know, I accepted that role as captain, you know, I wanted to lead by example. And I think that I made it a point to even try to do that harder, you know, once I was named captain, because I wanted these young guys that came up in New York to not necessarily, you know, follow me because I was loud and boisterous and yelled in front of the cameras, but I wanted them to follow me because I tried to be the first one to get my work done. I tried to be the first one in the weight room. I tried to be the first one, you know, out on the field for stretch. I tried to, you know, make sure that these young players saw me get my work in and followed that example to be on time, to play the game the right way, to, you know, to be courteous, to, you know, do the things away from the field that you're supposed to do. So, you know, that was very important to me. So that would be the role that I foresee other organizations, or this, or the Mets organization, you know, when naming another captain or the next captain, is, you know, somebody that is genuine, somebody that's organic, somebody that's doing it for the right reasons, not just because there's a camera in front of their face.
Mm-hmm. You know, John, and I think what David's come from is very true, but, you know, we all make it sound, make it a little bit sound like, you know, he was all, I mean, which he was all business, but you know what he did? He lightened up the clubhouse. This guy is a fun loving person. Don't let him kid you. As dedicated as he was to his job, he made the clubhouse fun. You couldn't walk in the clubhouse without having two or three guys sitting around him, and they were laughing. They were laughing about something. I mean, and so he lightened up the entire clubhouse. I mean, if it was, you know, he's the one who said, hey, we need the belt. We, you know, that year he went out and got the belt that we gave the player of the game, and guys enjoyed it. They enjoyed coming in the clubhouse. And I've talked to you before, John, you know, I used to be in the clubhouse a lot, probably more than I need managers should be, but I enjoyed being in there. And every time I was in there, and if he got up to move, three guys turned their heads to see what's he going to do. And that, to me, and again, this, the example that he set, and I'm not sure players today, you know, understand that. I really don't. They're so caught up. There's so much media and social media and all the other things, you know, and when behind those closed doors are where it plays, where, you know, you hang that ego on those doors before you walk in that room. And that's what I think, you know, David did. And I'm not sure today's players are like that. And I just think he learned that as he came through. But, you know, you got to have fun at the ballpark. And he, and David created fun in our clubhouse.
Yeah.
And that's a, actually a great point. And, you know, by Terry is that I do think that, and Terry and I have had conversations about this. And, you know, I think we came to a point where we said, you know, an hour before game time at home, there's so much downtime. You get there so early. You got batting practice first. There's a lot of downtime in between batting practice and the game. And, you know, it's inevitable that players are going to pull out their phones, or players are going to want to play cards, or players are going to want to, you know, we had a little mini basketball hoop that guys would shoot from in the clubhouse. You know, it's inevitable that guys are going to want to do this. But I think that, you know, like Terry said, you got to have fun, because in the grand scheme of things, it's a bunch of big kids playing a game for a living. But, you know, we agreed that, I think it was an hour before the game, that stopped. And we started preparing, going over game plans, going over video, starting mentally prepare for that game. So I think that there is a, like Terry said, which I think is often overlooked, that camaraderie, you know, that, hey, after a tough loss, let's go out and grab some dinner after the game and let's talk some baseball, or let's talk like, hey, what's going on? You know, just to free things up so that when we come back to the field the next day, we're playing for one another. I know that the guy to the right of me, you know, is having a baby, and that's stressful, and that he's not getting much sleep at night. And therefore, you know, we're pulling in the same direction, and that we have that unity because we know each other, not only as players, but we know each other away from the field as well.
Yeah. You, both of you have seen changes in the game, obviously. And there's, you know, there's generational changes that have happened in baseball. A lot of young guys that are coming in. What changes have you both seen with some of the younger players that are getting into the game now compared to your era?
Well, for Terry's case, they're starting to wear helmets now.
That wasn't funny, dude.
I know. You go first, Skip. Go for
well,
it.
Well, you know, obviously the game is changing. And so, you know, when I first came with coming up, and it's stuff I even taught when I was managing, you know, you talent plays, John. Talent wins. And so what you try to do is you take that talent and try to teach them how to win and the importance of winning and how to win baseball games. Sometimes you got to pass the baton to the next guy. And now it's all everything's wrapped up in what each and every guy does, what his numbers dictate. I mean, I have spent a couple of years when I left managing the Mets, I went through the minor leagues and, you know, the analytics started to come in, and guys were more concerned about their numbers than how they executed stuff on the field. And I mean, this past last year, I watched a lot of minor league games, and after the games, I would talk to some of the guys, and they're saying, well, geez, my exit velocity was down. Well, you didn't make contact three times. So who, you know, why don't we start working about, you know, a two strike approach to put the ball in play. And so maybe that stuff changes, but because that is what everybody looks at now, that they've gotten away from the ultimate thing. And that is in our game is to win at the major league level. And for me, that starts in the minor leagues. And so these young players, you know, do they learn how to win in the minor leagues? I'm not sure, because everybody downplays winning in the minor leagues. When I was a minor league manager, you know, I got accused, hey, look, you want to win too much. I said, yeah, when that guy goes to the big leagues, when my player gets to the big leagues, I want him to be able to contribute to winning. Tom Lasorda did not care if what somebody hit in AAA until they got to the big leagues and they showed him they could help him win a baseball game. And I'm not sure today, and again, I don't sit in meetings in the minor league clubhouses anymore, but I just, when I watch the minor league game, it's not played the same. And I think there's a way that, you know, to get good players, talented players. I'll tell you one thing, the guy that's on the screen right now, he wanted to win every night. He wanted to win. And when we didn't win, he tried to figure out how tomorrow we can win. And I don't think, I bet you could ask David how many nights he cared. How about, you know, I watched one game, he got a base hit to right field off Mariano Rivera to win a game. And I don't think he cared if it was 100 miles an hour or 25 miles an hour. It landed where nobody was at, and we won a game. And I think that's where, you know, the players today are kind of getting away from that and so worried about the stuff that's showing up on TV.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I think that there is certainly a place for the analytics, and I think Terry did a wonderful job when he managed in taking the numbers and utilizing them. You know, I think knowledge is king. You know, if you have the knowledge of the analytics and the feel of a baseball mind that Terry had, you can combine the two and have a perfect marriage. And I think that that's what makes managers great and what makes managers relatable to the players is having that feel, but also having the knowledge of the analytics. But I'm with Terry 1,000%. I think that not only in the professional level, but at the amateur level and on down, that we're not teaching these kids how to play the game correctly. You know, I think that we are, the game is changing to the point where, like Terry said, it's, you know, these different numbers when taking batting practice, as opposed to working on a feel that's going to be successful in the game. I think that the situation should dictate your mindset or the game plan that you bring to the plate per at-bat. Every at-bat isn't the same. There's going to be a time where you need to get a runner over. There's going to be a time where you need to get a runner in. You know, there's going to be a time where, hey, you're 3-1 sitting fastball, let it eat. You know, swing as hard as you can. You know, but that's not every situation. So I think that there needs to be a marriage between the two of that feel and that teaching the game correctly and playing the game correctly with the analytics.
Very good point. Yeah, there's so many changes today. But I'm going to go back in time for a minute, David. Your relationship with Jose Reyes. I can't begin to tell you how much joy the Met fans felt when you guys were both emerging. I mean, I've been a lifelong Mets fan since I was 9 years old. I went to my first game in 1966. And there's been a lot of ebbs and flows, a lot of ups and downs. We were so starved for stars. And you and Jose emerged at the same time. Really, you became stars. The fans loved you. One of my fondest memories was in 2006, seeing you and Jose celebrating on the field with the cigars, with the champagne, holding the signs. And that was just incredible that night. It was a lasting, lasting memory. And then, of course, you know, time passes. 12 years later, you're at your final game. And to your left, Jose Reyes is there. And what an emotional night it was for the entire city of New York. And to see you and Jose embrace when you were leaving that game was a memory that everybody remembers today. It'll live in everybody's memory in Mets history. What did Jose Reyes mean to you as a teammate, as a friend, and do you guys still stay in touch with each other?
Yeah, the short answer is that we're brothers. You know, I remember being 18 years old, Jose, right around the same age, Guy Conte, who was running our minor leagues at the time, who's a good friend of both Terry and I's, pull us in the office. And I'm 18 years old. I think I did something wrong, or, you know, my mind is starting to race. Like, what is the boss going to say to me, or what did I do wrong? And he pulls us in and we start talking a little baseball. You know, we start talking amongst ourselves, and he ends the conversation with, "You guys are going to be the left side of this infield for a long time at the big league level." And I remember both of us walking out of that at 18 years old and like, wow, you know, we gotta, you know, and that made us want it even more. Having that relationship, having that confidence walking out that door of that meeting, you know, I'll never forget it. And from that day on, you know, it was almost like we wanted it together. We didn't want it individually. You know, we didn't want it for ourselves. We wanted it for each other. And that was the way that we played the game. You know, we went through a lot of ups, a lot of downs, but the constant was that Jose knew me just as well as I knew myself. I knew him just as well as he knew himself. And it was so funny how two kids from completely different backgrounds, speaking two different languages, eating two different types of food, listening to two different types of music, could bond at that level and have a brother-like relationship. So, you know, one of the best friends that I've had in the game. And it just is a comfort level. When I look to my left, I want to see Jose Reyes manning shortstop because I know where he's going to play certain hitters. That makes me play a certain place. And we don't even have to go over the scouting report. I know by where he's playing or what his body language is, he could communicate with me that way. And that's how well we knew each other.
Yeah, that chemistry was evident. And you just knew looking at you play, and that last game was just it was an amazing memory. It really was. Terry, back to you.
Well, thanks, David. I'm going to let you go. I just want to thank you again for all your time tonight. You mean a lot to me. You mean a lot to this organization. Obviously, one of the one of the all-time great Mets, and one of the all-time great players. And I know you're enjoying your time with your kids. You should have some fun. And I look forward to seeing you down the road here pretty soon. And again, thank you so much for being my first guest on my first show.
Well, you're the best, and at some point, my three-year-old boy, I'm going to send him down to Florida to have you teach him some baseball, you know, because I want him playing the game the right way. So thanks for everything you've done for, you know, my career. Thanks for, you know, being a friend, and hopefully I'll see you again soon.
Thank you, David.
That was great to take a look back at that first talking with TC with David Wright, and I get goosebumps even watching it, Terry.
Yeah, you know, he's so special, John. He, you know, and I've said this many times, you know, he was a great player. Had he not gotten hurt, he's a Hall of Famer, but he's such a good person. You know, that sometimes everybody talks about what a great player was. That doesn't even take into the fact that this guy, his respect for people, the game, who he was, the city he played in, made him that much more special. And that's so... For him to do the first show was really, really cool.
It really, really was. It was great, and we'll have more great guests on Talking with TC as we progress during this exciting pennant season. But right now, we're going to go to the Tunnel to Towers Amazing Hero of the Week, and this week it's truly heartwarming. We're going to pay honor to Army National Guard Sergeant Carl Sampson, who receives his mortgage-free smart home from the Tunnel to Towers Foundation. Let's go to that right now.
We gather here today in Picayune, Mississippi to welcome the Sampson family into their brand new mortgage-free smart home.
I'm Kelly Sampson. My husband, Army National Guard Sergeant Carl Sampson, suffered a catastrophic injury in Iraq.
I was in the Marine Corps and the Army National Guard.
They were going to get the mail.
Yeah.
Got on the truck and they set off the bomb with a cell phone. And that's when he got blown up.
It has been 21 years since he was wounded in Iraq. And he's been through a lot of hard times through it.
Tunnel to Towers built us a specially adapted smart home to make Carl more comfortable and independent.
Oh, man, this is gorgeous.
Oh, wow.
Carl and Kelly are going to be very happy in this house. Carl can stay home. He could have a little independence and dignity when she's gone. He'll be able to do things for himself.
That's important for him. He just loves that.
To date, we've built over 100 catastrophic land and smart homes across the country.
These houses make all the difference in the world.
Tunnel to Towers has helped us so much. I cannot wait to play with all the toys, to dig into all the features. I don't think anybody could have done it better than Tunnel to Towers.
When I first met Carl, he had all his awards in a box called Jump, because he said nobody cared.
But he knows every time he wakes up and sees this place, he'll know people care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thankful.
Yep.
By giving $11 a month, you're joining us on our mission to do good. Go to T2T.org to make a positive impact.
We will have another T2T Amazing Hero on next week's show. Terry, that'll wrap it up for another week of the Terry Collins Show. And you can follow Terry on X and Instagram at @TerryCollins_10. And for those of you on Facebook, follow Terry there at the Terry Collins Show. You can follow me on X and Instagram at John Arezzi. Make sure to subscribe now to the Terry Collins Show, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And of course, on YouTube, where we have that channel there. So go to youtube.com/ The Terry Collins Show. Until next time, this is John Arezzi for Terry Collins. Have a great week, everyone.